The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. There are a lot of people that bring to life the movies and TV shows we love. And here on this show, I've had the privilege to talk to quite a few of them. Actors, writers, even critics are all part of the ecosystem of entertainment. Today, though, we are going to shine a light on an aspect of filmmaking that doesn't get enough love. The storyboard artist. The folks that take the script and begin to literally and figuratively sketch out what the scenes are going to look like before anyone ever picks up a stylus to begin animating, before anyone gets behind a camera to film. Without the storyboard artist, a lot of other people wouldn't know where to begin. They help decide angles, lighting, which characters are in a scene, and what they're doing when they're not speaking. Chris Copeland has worked on some of your favorite things, Invincible, The Witcher, Young Justice, and he made his directorial debut for DreamWorks on the series Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts. He's had a long career that began here in Chicago as a nerd who loved superheroes and now gets to help bring them to life. We talked about how a storyboard artist is one of the first people to visualize what a writer has written, how animation kept Hollywood alive during a time of crisis, and how you might know you're ready for the next phase of your career. Here's Chris Copeland. Chris Copeland, welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you for being here.
Oh my gosh, Don. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super honored and so excited that we finally got it done.
I'm so excited too. You know what? I'll guarantee you that most everybody listening to this show right now knows your work, but they might not know you. So for people who don't know you yet, who are you and what is it that you do?
Yes. My name is Chris Copeland. I'm a Chicago boy, born and raised Chicago, Illinois. I have been, however, though, my new home, Los Angeles. I've been here for almost 16 years now, which is crazy to hear. And I am a director at DreamWorks Animation. That's what I do for my job. I am a dad and a husband and a brother and a son of an amazing, amazing mama. That's a little bit about me. And I've been in animation. That's another story. I could tell the story of how I got into animation the day after I moved out here.
That's what we're here for. It's the whole point of the show, actually.
Yeah. So I've been in it for 15 years. Started as a storyboard artist and moved up into directing. Started at Warner Brothers Animation on all the DC animated superhero movies, worked at a lot of different studios, from Hasbro to Marvel to Cartoon Network to Titmouse. Yes, that's the name of a studio. Just Google it later. DreamWorks. I worked on a show called Kipo and the Age of the Wonder Beasts on Netflix, directed on that. And then I was on Invincible. My brother and I were on that for a year before coming over to DreamWorks and now directing and developing feature animated movies.
And man, you know, some of the stuff that you've worked on, that Young Justice, that Invincible, some of those Marvel, Kipo especially, like that's the kind of thing that gets, you know, really widespread attention. It's the kind of thing that people sit up and take notice. I think we've really had kind of a revolution, especially in that like animated space in the last few years. Are you excited about all that extra attention? You got to be in it like before it was cool, back when adults watching animated shows was for geeks and losers like me. Yeah, and now, now it's cool. Now they're headlining. Yeah. Now they're headlining like Comic-Con and stuff. Like now people are like, you know, there's a whole industry around speculation of what's going to happen on like the next season of Invincible. How are they going to adapt this or that? So like, are you excited about like that revolution?
I say it all the time, man. I say, you know, as a black nerd growing up in Chicago, dude, the homies on the block, they had the dope Jordan shoes on because they were doing all the selling drugs and MIs. I'm like, I'm just going to watch Dragon Ball. So like, being in this era where it's like blurs are celebrated, nerds are celebrated, and sort of like we can be sort of the cool kids in that way. Of course, I can't help but be excited about the evolution of that, where you're just like, you're waiting for society to like take notice of the things that you're excited about. That's always fun as hell. And I definitely exist in that space. Of course, having it as a job, but, you know, like there's that element where you're just like, yeah, I'm excited as hell. I'm also tired. Like, I just want to go to sleep because making those things is hard as hell. But it is a buddy of mine who's a designer. He said to me once, he said, the idea that like you can be driving on the freeway and you see a billboard for a superhero show. And the privilege that we live in now to where you can go, I'm not even going to watch that when it looks trash. Where there was an era where it was like, no, if it's a superhero show, I don't care how trash it is, you're watching it because there was so few and far between.
Listen,
it's crazy.
I think I straddle a few different communities as well. And I tell people and there's some seriousness to it and there's some lightheartedness to it. When it comes like for the lighthearted stuff, like, listen, I will support anything that's a superhero.
Yeah.
I'm gonna watch just about anything. The superhero.
Yeah.
If there's witches fighting demons, if there's a vampire slayer, if there's somebody in a cape, if they have laser eye, I'm going to watch it. And it's really cool. I think it's really, really cool that seems to be the macro culture right now, but eventually it's going to be nerd stuff again. Eventually it's going to be, you know, something else is going to take over the zeitgeist, and I'm going to long for the days when, you know, we were headlining Comic Con and all that. But on the other side, I don't know if you resonate with this at all, but like from a queer community perspective, I'm also one of those people that says, listen, if it's in the theater, and it's even a little bit about us, go give them your money, even if it's bad, especially if it's bad, because you don't understand how hard it was for somebody to make that thing and get it through.
Yes.
And if we don't show up for it, they may not make another one for a long freaking time.
Last one. Yeah. Yes. 100%. And that's the thing. It's the subsurface solidarity. Too, you know what I mean? Like there's the surface solidarity of like, this is material and it's cool and I'm interested in it, I'm gonna go see it. But then to your point, you're straddling so many different subcultures and subgroups, just in base level existence, you know, you've been in the queer community and just like as a black man, you're like, oh God, okay, if this is a black gay man that directed a superhero movie, that is a fucking miracle. That's a unicorn of an existence.
We were all watching
that.
I mean, I know that you're with DreamWorks right now, but the way that so many people came together to watch that X-Men 97 and cheer on the whole cast and crew. Like,
and
the
it's,
fact
it's
that
dudes.
It got made and it was, it got to be as explicit as it was with its, like,
yes.
Oh
yes.
Man. Oh, that was such a special, precious thing.
And here's the thing, Don, is like for the team that made that show, shout out to Chase Conley, one of the directors, my brother. Shout out to Jay Castorena, who's the supervising director on that. Shout out to Matt Bordenave, one of the storyboarders. My homie, Emi Yonemura, who was one of the directors as well. Those are just naming a few of the people on that show that I know personally. Some of the people that I know personally on that show, I'm just like, we're cohorts by proxy here and there. But the second that show came out, it was just like, no, man, I'm supporting it. Like my son just made it an amazing accomplishment, because it does, it speaks into, yeah, a bigger need, a bigger desire, I think, within all of us. And so it was very exciting to celebrate that thing.
And I think it really goes to how special like own voices representation is when telling stories. You know, a lot of people talk about like, oh, DEI in the entertainment industry, or DEI in just any industry or something, as that it's like this terrible thing. And it's like, well, no, the problem is that only a few people have gotten to tell story, have gotten to be in charge of deciding what stories are told and how those stories are told for so very, very long. And you're, you know, it might be okay for other people to also have, like, other people having a chance doesn't mean you're not going to still have a chance.
It's so crazy when you are involved in making any of these things, or being a part of making any of these things. It's so crazy how active some of those dynamics are, like tangibly active in the 9-to-5 of it. Even you're just like, no, that's not this spiritual philosophy. Like, no, it's a real tangible element that when built upon actually breeds amazing results on multiple levels, not just socially and more people feeling seen and acknowledged. But creatively, when you're breaking boundaries and barriers creatively, you are literally taking something that is so precious and valuable to us creatives, which is our state of thinking. You're taking our mind and you're massaging it and exciting it. That breeds amazing results. And so, yeah, it is very crazy. Like when you're looking around and seeing all of these different things that are being praised and lauded, and you're like, look, there's results here. There's amazing results here that also breed financial results for a lot of the studios. That it's just a beautiful thing to sort of see it and to be a part of it in any way. I'm super, super, super blessed in a lot of ways to be involved. Let alone to be an audience, to just be an audience of it. I'm like, oh my God.
So I'm actually really curious, because I really love people that have expertise in areas that people just don't always think about. And I think people kind of have an idea of what a director is. And I think people have an idea of like what a writer is. What is the storyboard artist doing for the show? What's a storyboard artist, and how do you get good at being a storyboard artist?
Yes, that's a great question. I don't know if you can even see it. Like, there's a stack of scripts right there in the corner. That's my, I hate these words, I'm throwing the script over there. I point that out because our job as a storyboard artist starts there. Once the writer has written the script out, typically by that point, the executive producer and the showrunner have gotten their read through it. They've given notes and have made adjustments on it. And then comes time for that director. If it's an episodic show, that director then takes that script and they divvy it up. So they'll have on their team, they'll have three to four storyboard artists, and they will take that script and break it up into page counts to evenly distribute the page counts to each storyboard artist. And sometimes it's uneven, but it's because of the math. So one of the storyboard artists will get 4 pages and the other ones will get 10 to 15. It's like, yo, what the hell is that? But if you read through the script, you'll see that, well, those 10 to 15 pages, these are just talking scenes. And so that's not much. Those 4 pages, that's the big act 3 battle scene. And every character from the whole episode is in there. And this storyboard artist now has to take those sequences and literally draw them out. And so as a storyboard artist, you get your handout is what we call it, which is all your pages. You sit and talk with your director and you guys walk through the script. Okay, we're in act 1. There's a little action moment here that I got, but it's an act 1 action moment, which means it shouldn't be the biggest action moment in our show because that costs money. Animators overseas have to animate that. Our designers have to design. So you got to pace it out. So you're sitting with your director and you're figuring those things out. And then you literally go and you take those words and you turn them into images. And the way you do that is if you could see my screen here, I'm drawing on what's called a Cintiq. It's a screen that you draw mm-hmm. right onto.
Oh, and, I know.
Yes, there you
I'm
go.
A yeah, terrible I'm like artist, that. But I'm an artist.
But you know
terrible
that.
One.
You know that space. Uh-huh. So, yeah, we sit and we have the program that I work in is a program called Storyboard Pro. And Storyboard Pro is like a marriage of like an editing, like Final Cut. It's like a marriage of Final Cut and Photoshop. And so you can draw, you have a little box frame that is the ratio of whatever the show is going to be, the screen ratio. And you can draw your whatever in there, like, oh, I have an idea of this shot. This moment calls for this character to go into this room and find the blah, blah, blah. So you're drawing your things out there. The great thing about it is the Final Cut Pro element of it is that I can push play on it and it'll play through my sequence and I can stop it and go, oh, right here, I actually want that shot to look like this or to look like that. So a storyboard artist, their responsibility is literally to take that script and turn those words into cinematic images. And once we do that, so somewhere here, like DreamWorks, we have all of our animators in-house because it's CG and, you know, we get it over to our layout artist who puts it into a program and gives it a lot more of that camera finesse. But on TV shows, you are packaging up those storyboards and sending them most of the time. Storyboards, designs, color scripts, whole different thing. You're sending those overseas to your studio that's going to take their team of animators and animate based on the storyboards that you did. So it's literally the first hands that gets to turn the movie into a movie by adding the visual. And it requires a lot of different strengths in terms of artistry. You're limited by how well you can draw the things that are in your mind. So mm-hmm. I draw a lot. I draw too much probably. So, but it broadens my ability to work as a cameraman in a way. And then it's, but then also story, understanding setups and payoffs and through lines and character dynamics and things of that nature. It all behooves you to know more about that as a storyboard artist. And if you want to get into directing,
how do you know when you've reached a specific point in your own kind of personal artistic journey? I think I follow a lot of, I think I follow so many people these days who are making a career out of, you know, mostly being self-taught. I'm not seeing as many people on social media these days that are going to an art school and then coming away and, you know, getting an animation. Yeah. It seems like a lot of people are like on their iPad figuring it out. Yeah. So how do you know when you like, where, how do you know? Because comparison is the thief of joy. I believe that. But also you kind of have to be looking around and going, okay, I think I'm about where these people are, I don't think I've reached it yet. Like what the person who thinks they're ready, how do they know? What is there something that they should be looking at or whatever to know that they're ready? And for the person who doesn't think they're ready, is there something that maybe, I don't know, some hope to give them to be like, maybe you're more ready than you think you are?
Yeah. It is as much to your point, as much as comparison is the thief of joy, the reality is that there is a healthy version of comparison.
Yeah.
I'll liken it. Another thing that I loved growing up, just for example, basketball. Basketball was my other love. And I remember, look, I'm pretty good on the court, especially when I was younger. Like now, 43, my knees are just like, listen, stop. Go sit down and draw. But, you know, in my younger days, because
somewhere LeBron is quaking right now. Quaking. Because
LeBron
he definitely
is looking
listens
at
to
me and
show.
Going, yeah. What a peasant you are, Chris. That's what LeBron is thinking and is my but I remember because my brother, his office is literally on the other side of this wall. But I remember we would play basketball all the time and we were good. We had a good squad. I remember the first time playing against some college D1 guy. We would go to this open gym where we were all just hooping and we're passionate as hell. When you're watching The Sandlot, that was us except on a basketball court, bro. Like, we're like, yo, let's go. Man, and dominating whatever team gets in that. Man, I remember these dudes came in the gym and they had on their warm-up stuff. And we're hoping against them. We're playing them. And it was a close game. It was a tight game. The mistake we made is we started talking shit to these guys. Don and I'm telling you right now, it's like in Naruto when you see what's the guy in the green? The green, oh God, it's just going to kill me. I'm forgetting his name.
There's a lot of anime you could have named, but I've never seen that one.
He's a good fighter, but then he takes off his leg warmer. He takes off his leg weights one episode. That was these guys after we started talking shit. They took their warm-up stuff off, Don, and I'm telling you, it was this realization of like, oh, no, those guys, that's that other level. That's that other level. I'm not I am not going to the NBA. That was that moment of realization for me. I said, there is no way I'm ever – and to compare that to art going like – when you see someone that you're just like, no, that person is executing on a level that is so clearly over there that I'm like, okay, I need that sort of gas for myself. So I think a big part of when do you know is a tough one just because it's like psychologically being kind to yourself and being honest to yourself. And I think oftentimes we don't understand that those can both be true at one time. You can be honest with yourself and also be kind to yourself. We beat ourselves up. I had to get to a space where I was just like, I can be ambitious and see other artists that are doing things that I dream of executing at a level that I dream of executing at, but I don't have to shit on myself the whole time and go like, you're never going to do that. You can't do that. You're not going to da da da. No, no, no. What is that person doing that I admire so much? And once I figure out those little elements and I put it up here, I call it my carrot that I chase constantly. Mm-hmm. It's just a little thing that I have hanging up there and I just reaching for it, but not beating myself up over not accomplishing or getting it. And so I think a big part of knowing when you're there is when you are dreaming and you're pursuing that dream with the stuff that you're doing. And you're literally going, I can achieve the thing that I'm seeing up here. I can put it down on the paper or on the iPad or on the Cintiq. I think that is the place where you know you've made it. And the caveat to that, know you've made it, is I go, you know you've made it to where you need to be at that moment in your life. That's the caveat. Because the goalposts will move. It's such a nebulous thing.
Well, that's the thing, is that, like, you know, when I talk to writers, you know, I'm not ready, or you know what, they always seem to compare themselves, one, to like the greatest of the greats. Oh well, you know, yeah. I'm not Stephen King. Okay, well, there aren't a lot of people that are Stephen King.
Yeah,
and somehow. Yeah. Somehow there's a lot of people that still write best-selling yes. books in a lot of other yes. genres and make a tidy living.
On certain Tuesdays, I'm sure Stephen King is not even Stephen King. That's the thing. On a bad day, you know.
And once you get just a little bit behind that curtain, yeah. you realize, oh, Stephen King is Stephen King because he shows up every day. Yes. I think he still is on a typewriter at his typewriter like 8 a.m. and doesn't yeah. leave until 5. He treats it like a job.
Yes.
Whether something good comes out, whether he stares at the same 400 words all day, he's showing up and treating it like a job. Did you show up? Are you showing
That's
up?
It.
When was the last time That's you showed it. Up? How did you show up when you showed up? And I think that a lot of people, I see so many people selling these courses. Here's, let me teach you all yeah. the publishing secrets to get a 6-figure publishing deal. I'm going to teach you all the secrets. Oh, give me $500. I'm going to teach you the secrets. And the funny thing is, I can't find those people's names on a book cover.
No,
anywhere.
No.
Because if they had all and these secrets, they'd be doing it.
They'd be doing it. If everyone could, everyone would. And
everyone would.
I used to do, my brother and I, we used to actually teach storyboard classes. And we would teach them online. And listen, it was great. For a moment, it was really cool and exciting. And yes, there was a financial incentive to it. My love for people and pursuit of people predicated that there was going to be a temporary space. There was going to be an epiphany that I would get where I would go like, oh, no, this feels wrong in some way. But it wasn't that I reached an epiphany and felt like I was doing something unethical or immoral. But it was this realization that like what my classes would always find themselves relegated to was me talking about your love of the craft, do you love drawing? If you do not love drawing, do not get into storyboarding. And when I say, do you love drawing? There are days where I wake up a lot of times at like 4 a.m. to draw, literally to draw, to sketch characters, to do weird expressions, check some expression, like to check if I'm putting too many lines down to accomplish the idea I have in my mind, or if I can delete some of those lines and still get the like economy. I'll watch some show that I've watched 9 million times, and I'll find a little moment where I'm like, the way that that animator handled the foreshortening on that arm, I need to do that. Like, I got it. So if you don't have that, find it or acknowledge that you're not going to get it, whatever it is that you need to do. But that love for sitting there and doing the thing, because like I said earlier about the excitement for the content that we're making right now, the reality is that sometimes it is a job. Most times it is a job that I'm like, I would rather just sit with my wife and my kids and play a video game and eat junk right now, you know, but I'm like, no, I love this thing. And that's what's going to get me to sit down in front of this Cintiq with an empty panel in front of me and find in my mind a thing to do. So yeah, I think it's beautiful that I did it. You're talking about Stephen King. He sat down to do it. You sit down to do it. And it's the same with this craft. It's the exact same.
When it just really reminds me that like the people that end up being successful are the people, you know, they get their rejection or they get their bad day or they have, you know, whatever it is. And you eat your ice cream and you watch your comfort shows and you lick your wounds and you have, and then the next morning you're like, I figured it out. I know why that didn't work. I know why it didn't work, and now I can fix it. And oh my God. And but it's like, you're going to have those moments when it's like, I would like to do literally anything else. Why did I choose this? This is the stupidest career choice I've ever made. Like, why did I say yes? Could I give the money back? Could I give the publisher the money back? Yeah. I don't want to do this anymore. I could just regular job. And I could just collect a paycheck and not care. And then the next day it's like, oh, I got it. I got it. You feel like a genius again. It's great.
Yes. It's that thing. And so, that it's so special. For me, because there are these tangible, I guess I would call them practical, but they're probably not, but they're practical theoretically, but just these things that draw more, understand anatomy, understand character, understand story. There are all these different things, but I came to find this sort of reality in my mind was that I need something that compels me toward those elements. And it was my love for drawing. Being on the south side of Chicago as a kid and the escapism of imagination and drawing with my brothers and, you know, the pat on the head you get from your mom when you show her something cool. Like, I guess I just constantly live for that energy, and it's what brings me to the desk daily.
I want to talk about some of the realities of the entertainment industry for a second. Maybe some tough love to anybody who's listening who wants to be where you are one day. So, you know, you used to hear a lot of stories about people doing what you did, you know, leaving and going off to Hollywood, and you got $200 in your pocket, and you know, and 15 years later, you're a director for, you know, Marvel and Image Comics DC and all of that. How is that still a thing these days?
It is. It really is. Yeah, it really is. It is. And with caveats. And I don't think either of us has the time or the energy to even list half of those.
What if I give you $500 and we call it a course? Could you give me the secret?
Let's go. Okay. I was looking for my new class. there are these caveats, but that I think right now, speaking toward the bigger industry, right now, studios post-COVID, what ended up happening during COVID was these studios made a lot of money because we were all, I always say, man, COVID was the greatest lesson in life for equality that I think humanity will ever experience, because that disease was like, I don't give a fuck what you look like, I don't give a fuck where you live. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care. I will kill you. And we're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, that guy, that disease is not racist. I promise that. So, like, the thing about that time, though, is that we were all relegated to consuming entertainment. Of course we were. We were on our phones watching. We were, man, we had all of them, all of the apps, Apple Plus, Prime, Netflix, all sure. of it. And so what happened there is the companies were making gangbusters, just money on top of money. And they struck a deal with the electronics, with the engineers, and that deal was not a good one. We used to have reruns. Reruns was a sustainable financial system. You make something, it would go out overseas. Once the people over here were done with it, it would go overseas. Overseas companies would pay for it, and then it would come back, and we'd watch them again, and those were reruns. We gave that up because the upfront money from Netflix and Amazon for a lot of these CEOs was pretty great. It was like, look, people are paying money to come onto this platform. It just wasn't sustainable. It's not a very sustainable platform. I bring that up to go, what happened as a result of that, we're seeing it now, where now what everyone is doing, what a lot of studios are doing, are IPs. This is why Inside Out 2 is doing what it's doing. This is why Kung Fu Panda 4 is doing what it's doing. This is why, you know, like, it's resuscitating those franchises, going like, we know it, we can trust it, we know fans love it, and look, those things are making money. What's happening as a result of that, though, is that that is not a sustainable consumption pattern. We're gonna get tired of the same five Panda stories. 6, yeah. Cars 9, you know, all that. You're gonna get tired of it. And I think what we're gonna experience on a bigger level, I think we're stepping into it right now, actually, on a bigger level, is a re-experience of the indie boom that happened long ago. I really think so. I think what we're seeing,
A24 is showing us that you can do it,
dude.
If you're good, you can do it.
Yes, yeah, and it's a thing where the reason why I say it's going to be bigger than before is because when it happened before, it was just with a couple of films, a couple of movies, and things like that. But listen, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse did crazy numbers because it was Spider-Man, but it was an original indie level take on Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. What if Spider-Man was some Latino kid from Brooklyn? Oh shit, let's see that. And then the technology allowed for those things to be explored in an amazing, amazing way. And there's a show on Netflix called Arcane that I think is did something similar with the gaming. And they're going like, yo, executed at this high level. Blue Eyes Samurai is doing something like that. I think we're going to see a resurgence of these indie executed levels of big franchises that's really going to offer a diverse group of people the ability to do things in this industry. And I'm saying this as a guy who has sat and talked with a lot of these captains of these studios. This desire to do something fresh, new, and different, I think we're going to see that re-up in a big way in the next 10 years for sure. So I say all that.
I agree with you. I think my question to anyone on the inside of the entertainment industry right now is, where do you see these stories being consumed? Because it isn't mm-hmm. in a movie theater these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, or at least mm-hmm. not as much as it used to be.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
We still aren't seeing pre-COVID levels of theater attendance. So where are these stories going to be consumed? No.
For some. For some, I mean, and this is, and that's the thing. Maybe I should have caveat this with like my perspective. A lot of my perspective is on the animated front. Because,
well, and I do want to ask about that as well, specifically because animation pretty much was the salvation of Hollywood during and post pandemic, because it was one of the only kinds of media that could continue to be produced during lockdown. Voice actors for, what was it, Moana, I think, that's how long ago this was, were like doing it in their closets at home. Animators were able to work on things remotely. Like, animation was the thing that continued to uphold Hollywood.
Absolutely.
But I'm also hearing from some people that animation is not getting that love right now anymore. And that well is starting to dry up a little bit for animation.
We are having to, we have a rally, the union that I'm in, we have a rally coming up on the 10th next week, where showing up to negotiate, to cry out.
I saw the voice actors. I saw on Jennifer Hale's Instagram that voice actors are on strike.
Yeah. So it is this thing of like, we are, man, it's this great, horrible dynamic where on one hand we have to continue to humanize ourselves and make ourselves present and remind the higher ups. But then on the other hand, you know, the leg that we're standing on is a fragile one, you know, because we're going like, God damn, you know, a lot of my homies, talented homies who have been out of work for over a year now, you know, and I often remind people that don't forget the last time we were in a negotiating room with these folk. There was a leaked email, and it was Sarandos or one of them that said, "We will bleed them dry."
Yep, I remember that.
That reverberates in my mind constantly. And here's the thing, Don. Like, I am, you know, my wife and I have four kids, 16, 14, 11, and 8. I'm blessed that in my career, in the 15 years that I've been doing it, rarely have I gone. I've been on unemployment once, thank God, knock on wood. And it was a stressful time. And it wasn't that long. It was maybe for 3 months or so. But I remember that was like in the second year of me being in this industry. I remember how stressful and painful that was. I grew up poor as hell. I remember us not having electricity, not eating certain nights. And it didn't get to that point when I was unemployed, but I know some of my homies who've been out of work for a long, long time, they're experiencing that. And I don't forget the words that were spoken by some of these higher ups that were so degrading and hopeless. But I guess I'm an eternal hopeful optimist. And I have my brother and I always have a plan in mind to like activate stuff and go like, well, shit, move around resources and make dope shit. AI is a scary conversation for a lot of creatives right now. My brother and I are going like, fuck, man, we got to get in front of it then. Like, what if all in the generative AI landscape right now, where they're just taking art from individuals that have invested this time and energy of their lives to make themselves the artists that they are. These companies are just taking that. What if we grab the hold of that generative AI and I put my own art in that algorithm and I have it spitting my own shit out? Does that move us forward in some way? Thinking on trying to get in front of a lot of this shit, because these people can pull the rug from beneath us. But what I am seeing right now, when I'm looking at Inside Out, do the numbers that it does, even though it's an IP. When I'm looking at Kung Fu Panda 4 doing the numbers that it does
I think the Mario movie needs to be in that conversation as well. It did crazy numbers last year.
Yeah, Spider-Verse with this almost 700 million. I'm looking at this and I'm going, those are numbers that you cannot deny, because this is what this is all about. It's money. It's a money game. And so I think we are in this weird tension point right now. But if I can offer hope to anyone, it is, I do not fit the description of a successful director and animation in Hollywood. I don't fit it, but I believe in the craft. I believe in what I do. I believe in the people that I'm blessed to be around. And I go, if we lock arms and create and we create and we create, at some point, those creations are going to be seen, heard, and acknowledged. And we're seeing versions of that right now in this industry, in a lot of little micro ways. So I have hope. I have hope.
You know, you brought up two points that I want to bring together. You brought up AI, which no matter what creative person I talk to, I mean, you know, authors, book cover designers, mm-hmm. voice mm-hmm. actors. I mean, my gosh, we're making AI voices now, voiceover sounds, you know, all that, because I don't want to call it art. you know, so, you know, everybody in every kind of creative field is staring down the barrel of the existential threat of AI. But you also brought up the Spider-Verse movie, which has been used for good mm-hmm. and for ill as an example mm-hmm. of a time when AI can be used as a tool. You also brought that up for yourselves. So I'd like for maybe the listeners to get a little bit of this is what it can do, this is what it shouldn't do from somebody on the inside. When can AI be a tool? And when is AI an existential threat to human creativity?
Yes. It's a good question. It's something that I had to, my brother Justin, he's a year older than me, but he has the wisdom of our grandparents that we never met. So he's always cueing me in, because he'll sit and read stuff for a long time. And me, I'm just like, listen, if the words are not hieroglyphics, I'm not reading it. Leave me alone.
Your texts are just all emojis.
I was just like, listen, man, like, show me your expression. Don't say it. But no, over the last couple of years, just out of responsibility as an artist in this industry, I've been doing a lot of looking into the AI tension. And my buddy, shout out to my buddy, John Lamb, J-O-N-L-A-M. If you, and on Instagram, he's at John Lamb. He's a character designer, storyboard artist, director. He's a phenomenal human. He has been putting the fire to the feet of the corporations that have been pushing and promoting AI, along with a bunch of other top tier artists, buddies of mine. But the generative, so just for the record, AI is not the problem. Artificial intelligence is not the problem. And in fact, if you look at an iPhone, if you look at Google, if you look at even gaming, AI, artificial intelligence, has been active and present for a long time. A program that is created to ingest the information that it's given and spit out a result. That has been active for a long time. The issue that a lot of artists we're running into is not with AI as much as it is this other thing that we know as generative AI, which generative AI does similarly to what, you know, regular AI does. It takes the input of information and it spits it out. But generative, it takes information that is not, that is, for all intents and purposes, proprietary to that artist without that artist's permission or acknowledgement. And it takes that data and it builds a separate entity and, you know, puts that entity out. And so it will take different in the shorthanded version. It'll take the way that I draw hands or eyes in the specific way that I do it. And it'll mix it with the way that another person will draw feet and arms. And then it'll put together this Frankenstein of an image utilizing our skill sets without any sort of acknowledgement, let alone financial compensation at all. And it would this generative AI is doing this, individuals with boatloads of money building these infrastructures to utilize this generative AI. That is the scary version. Now, to your question about when can it be a tool, if, again, like in the example I gave you earlier, if I have access to a program that goes, tell me what you want and give me the input. So, okay, well, I want to build a show that is a sci-fi space show. And it goes, okay, well, what's the input? What library am I referencing? And I go, here are all of my drawings of spaceships, of astronauts, of different planets. Here's all of them. And that program takes all that I've done and goes, oh, based on your style and everything, here's a version that you know, that we put, then that's a tool that I'm using with my own library. Let's go. Let's work with that. Let's figure that out. That would be a way to use it as a tool that is predicated on my own input, that is putting out work and information based on what I put into it. A tool that gives you something without you giving it anything, there's no level of alchemy that that ever ends up in a good place, right? Like, and that's what generative AI is. I have nothing that I'm bringing to you except a word prompt, and you're giving me a library of outputs. The even exchange is non-existent there, and it's violating time, energy, effort, and for all intents and purposes, it's violating hopes and dreams of individuals who've invested into the craft in a scary way. So I'm waiting for that tool set. I'm waiting for that to be created and built, but you know, people are greedy. People want money. So it's like, it's,
well, and you know, that I brought that up because you mentioned Spider-Verse and the yeah. animators on Spider-Verse talked about the fact that one, in order to kind of meet the time demands, they used an in-house AI, mm-hmm. but like mm-hmm. you're saying, it was uploaded with their own work, their own body yes. of work, and it stayed in-house in their own body of work. And all it was really used was to improve their own workflow. No, it wasn't no, used yes. to create the movie. It wasn't used to storyboard no. the movie. It's used to no. improve a workflow, and it still is then edited by the people whose work was used to create it. And it's a yes. whole different, that is using it as an ethical tool. The consent, the exactly. compensation piece, all of that's there. All of that's yes. there.
Yep.
You know, but the people that are like, oh no, I'm an ethical, look at me. And then, you know, they draw a stick figure. That they ran yes. through Midjourney and said, make this look like ugh. Greg Land drew it. And it's like, okay, well,
God,
that's not how that is. That's still not feeding something to it. That's still not having it create you an image based on your work. Like, yes, you might've given it your stick figure, but then you had it dress it with a Greg Land dressing. So no, that's still not consent. That's still not compensation. It's not, you know.
And it sucks. And that's, I think like I was saying, right, I think figuring out ways, at some point we have to eradicate our fear of these things. I remember when I got into animation in 2009, I remember it. I was walking through the hallway at Warner Brothers on my first day, and there was just a line of boxes against the wall in that hallway. And in those boxes were Cintiqs. And this is when Warner Brothers had gone like, all right, we're going to be done with paper and pencil. Mm-hmm. We're going to do our storyboards. Everyone's going to be given a computer and a Cintiq to do your storyboards on. And I remember there are a lot of old school storyboard artists who had their paper and, you know, and they were just like, man, this is the death of this industry. Yeah. This is how this shit goes down. And there was a valid concern that like, now you're going to get these overly ambitious artists who won't acknowledge that storyboarding is about storytelling. They're going to be finessing their boards and all these crazy ways, la 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 la. And a lot of folks were just like, I'm done. I'm out. I'm not doing this. I'm not dealing with it. And there were a lot of those guys who were like, well, no, I still draw. I get to just do it on this screen now. Mm-hmm. And the evolution of the industry is you don't go into a studio where every desk doesn't have a Cintiq on it. And you know what? The job is still hard as hell. In fact, it's even harder because our social evolution of it meant we can do a lot. You can't look at a show like Arcane and not go, that is happening on that level because we've evolved. We have evolved. And I do think that there's going to be an evolution that comes from the AI tool once we can get the mongers out of the way, the mongers who are just going, there's a financial benefit to it, and I don't care who loses. Once we get those individuals, okay, that's not happening. Class action lawsuits are real, beat it. Once we get that out of the way and we're able to really take this tool and do what we did with so many pieces of technology, I think we're going to make some pretty amazing stuff with it. But right now it's sort of like, let's just keep tiptoeing through it all. And let's not be afraid of it, though. Let's figure out a way that we can build it.
Not to make it political for a second, but I will say and this isn't a political thing, but polls tell us, recent survey data tells us, people hate AI. People hate it. They hate opening an app up and talking to an AI robot. They hate being forced to search an AI robot when they search their Instagram. They hate people are hating AI. They're hating it real bad. Yes. In fact, the market, stock market is reacting to that. Like all these companies that invested all this money in AI. Amazon saw a dip.
Amazon
saw a dip.
Yes.
Like all these huge companies that made all this investment in AI are like, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Maybe people hate this.
Because it feels so, it feels like cringy.
It feels like you're talking to a robot.
It does. And I'm just like, I think the horse, like the cart before the horse and all that, like there's just, to my benefit, it's funny. My brother and I, we've sat in a few meetings and have pitched shows and ideas and things. And one of the things that we talk about is resuscitating things that we socially have too fast moved past, right? And so when you look at certain, for instance, Kickstarters for like video games, you look at like a Kickstarter, most of those are people doing what? Retro versions of things. They're going back, they're doing the retro stuff because we're so fucking consumptuous and
so
greedy.
Many people are going back that like side scroll format. Oh god, yes, and stuff side scroll. I missed the, what was it, 8-bit or 16-bit or whatever. I'm gonna get it that language
18
wrong,
and
that,
like, 16. Yeah, 8 and 16.
Yeah, those pixels.
Nintendo was 8. Super
Like
Nintendo
Octopath
was 16.
Traveler, like people like, oh man.
I don't know if you ever played
back
Donkey
when
Kong
your brain
Country.
Had to kind of fill in the blanks of stuff. And it was the joy of reading, because you get to play the movie in your head and the character can look like what you want her to look like. And
it
and
is
all
happening.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
It's happening. And I speak excitedly about that. I'm not anti-evolution of things.
No, it's cool.
I love
it. I still play
Genshin
Impact.
So cool.
Those effects are cool. Oh, that's very cool.
Okay. That the visuals on Genshin Impact still inspire. Like I'm still looking at that and going, like they're doing shit.
I know,
that's just not,
and it's on my phone. How does that work?
Oh my
that's
god,
witchcraft.
And that's the thing. It's that's the thing. It's like we can't rush past these things because there's still a space for them. And I say that as an encouragement. I like for filmmakers, for writers, for creatives is. A lot of times the best stories that we find is when we go back into our experiences that we erased or moved past too quick and we resuscitate those things and go, oh my God, there was a detail in there that I never even thought of existed. And when you show that to this wide berth of people, this wide, diverse group of individuals, and everyone raises their hand and go, I fucking know that thing. And all of a sudden we're connected. I think there's something to going back sometimes, slowing down, going back, grabbing something, and then pulling it back.
In that space, mm-hmm. we talked about IP. We're talking a little bit about nostalgia. We're talking about, in the animation space, in the publishing space, in creative spaces, there is a tension that exists between giving people something new, the desire to innovate, to put a new spin on a certain kind of story, a new spin on a certain kind of animation, giving people a new look, you know, a new look to characters. Mm-hmm. We're so used to, you know, people talk about Disney's same face syndrome, or you know, like just the different ways that certain studios put out work that it all just kind of looks the same after a while. There's a tension though, because when things go too new, people don't show up. People are like, nah, I don't know what that is. That looks dumb.
Yeah.
But then they complain about same face syndrome, but they'll show up for same face syndrome.
But that's what I'm
So how do you innovate while serving audiences something that they at least recognize and therefore want to see?
Yes. It's a great question. I remember David Fincher, my all-time favorite director, and you know, pray to the altar of that man. I remember He's got a prickly personality when you see him in interviews. He's very just like cut and dry. Just like, no, that's stupid. You do this. And then you'll watch one of his movies and you're like, well, shit, there it is.
That's why he gets to say that.
Yeah, that's why he is that way, because he's that. But I remember reading an interview with him once, and he was saying something. And this is in my animation infancy, where I was just like, I'm still figuring out what a storyboard is. But I remember he said something that stood out to me, and he said, and I didn't get it at the time. He said, I don't care about an audience. I don't give a shit what they think while I'm building and creating what I'm creating. I don't care. And I just remember being like, well, that feels anti-Chris Copeland because I'm a people guy. It's people over everything is my core value. I'm like, what? Those are people. But over time, I came to realize what he was speaking to. He was speaking out of his place of like, I have to create what I think is amazing and dope and inspiring for me. I have to, because that's all that I have. I cannot go, oh, I know what Don wants to see, or I know what Justin, or I know what da-da-da. The diversity, if I really value the diversity of the human experience, there is no way that I can take a desire to satiate an audience and put that at the forefront of being honest with myself creatively. And I think it starts there. I have to, like, in my mind is a library of things that inspire me, that look cool and interesting and amazing. And when I, as a visual guy, as a creative, the second that I see something in my mind, I have to be very careful with that thing. And I have to be very methodical with how I go about bringing it into existence. And once I do that, and I go, okay, here's everything that I have up there in my noggin. Here's all of it on the table. Now I can start to bring in a select few of these people to go like, what do you, do you see what I'm trying to do there? Like, it's those baby steps of creating something and putting it out and into the world. And I guess if I were to give like a, hey, here's the way we're going to push the thing forward, it goes back to what I was saying earlier of be kind to yourself, because the time that you spend oftentimes beating yourself up, which often unfortunately is trauma based that you can control. You're just the recipient of it. But finding the way, the venue, rather help, you know, with people around you or a specialist, finding a venue into that beautiful mind of yours, I think that is the starting point to going, well, what does that beautiful mind love? And what is it inspired by? And what does it want to put out there? Because that's all it is. I think everything that we're inspired by is, we're just taking stuff that we see and think is cool and interesting, and we're putting it out there to share with people. So it always comes back to be kind to self and allow that self to put some of that weird shit out there and revise it later on, because that thing is going to be a beautiful vehicle to someone else finding a venue into themselves, and they're going to put something else out there that we're then inspired by. So I don't know. That's my version of it. Maybe more hippie than it should be, but
I don't know. It sounds like you're just telling us that we all exist in the context of all it. In which we live.
God, bro, that's...
You didn't just fall out of a coconut tree, Chris.
This is not political, Don.
No, I didn't say that. No, I just, no, no. It's just something that, you know, his grandmother used to say.
God, I love it.
Thank you.
I love it.
You know,
okay, I'm just going to say, I've been in this, okay, never mind. I've just been in this space where since.
The memes are just so good. It's just the memes are so good.
I heard one podcast that I listened to, and a lady goes, she said, listen, I'm just going to say it like, black girl. She goes, we are winning right now. She's like, there's been a resurgence of a win right now for us in a certain political landscape. That feels like, oh my God, we can actually do this. And I'm like, it was something so beautiful about that, but also so fucking ridiculously comedic about like, oh my God, like the breath of fresh air that we're able to sort of like enjoy for the moment right now. Where it's like
wild. It feels
it's
like
wild.
You're from Chicago, so you get this. It's that one week in February when it just suddenly goes from like 28 degrees to like 70 for reasons that it just randomly, like in February, you'll get like a 72 degree day.
I'm telling you, and Don, here's the thing that's beautiful about you bringing that. I have not thought about that in forever.
Yeah.
It is a spiritual experience.
Oh,
it is,
man.
Like, oh my God.
It's like, so it bitterly cold for so many months. And then just randomly, then just we all wake up and it's 60.
Oh, and then let it happen on like a Saturday when you don't have school or something. Oh my God. That, so yes, I'm in that vibe on a lot of different things right now where I'm just going like, no, you know what? And maybe it is hope. Maybe it is some crazy thing like that. And I am reminded of the audacity of hope. There is a sense of that energy resuscitating in the last few weeks. And I'm like, no, not just for socially, but creatively. And I'm going, no, fuck that, man. Like, what we have done, the human spirit, when they really give a shit about each other, the things that we've locked arms and have done historically, I'm just like, I'm gonna live in that shit.
Just to bring it back to an artist and creative perspective for a sec, if you don't feel like the world is about to blow up at any second, it is amazing how much work you can send. Like, you can get back you can get back to your desk. You can get back to your keyboard. You can draw back. I mean, you can take all that fear and you can channel it into art. But if you're just if you're just doom scrolling and you're just like, oh my God, what if somebody says something and now we're, you can break away from that.
I don't know who it was. I don't know. And maybe it's something that I made up, but I don't know who it was that said it. I feel like
if it was good, I said it.
It was probably you, Don. It might have been you. That might have been the first video I've seen. I saw yours, and I was like, "Yeah, this is the person right here that I'm." but it was. I feel like it was Noam Chomsky, but I can't be
probably,
sure. But I remember someone saying, "We were never meant as a species to hear the thoughts, opinions, and ideas of everyone around us at one time."
Yeah.
There was no space where there was ever going to be good for us.
No.
And I think of that often. Oftentimes I'll experience something amazing. I remember going to New York and going to Ellis Island for the first time. Mm. And I had this instinct in my soul. I was like, oh, let me take a photo. And then I said, no, I'm not going to take a picture. I'm not going to share it on Insta. I'm like, this is for me. Mm-hmm. My mind is going to feed on this and it's not going to be shared with anyone. This is going to go back to like the immigrants when they first got here on Ellis Island, that they were only able to recapture it and say it in a way that drove you to an emotional space. And I said, I want to recapture that energy out of respect and honor of those people. And I think about that often. I look at the Statue of Liberty and it exists in my mind in the way that I experienced it. And it feels so authentic and beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, there are times where we don't need to put it all out there. There are times where it's like, no, sit with it and hold on to it and watch what grows from it. And I find myself as I get older, respecting and loving some of those moments more and more lately. I don't know.
Well, I think it just kind of makes sense that you have the worldview that you have and the ethic of care for other people that you have.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you can't be a superhero fan and not like, you can't grow up with superheroes and like not care about other. I mean, I don't know. There's some weird fanboys out there and some weird subgenres.
Sure.
And I'm like, did you even watch the show? Did you even read the comics that you say you like?
But also your kink idea for that character. I never thought of that. And I thank you for it. There's some of that. But no, I'm telling you, when I was a
kid. The guys with the Superman tattoos or the Punisher tattoo, I'm like, buddy, both of those people would be disappointed in you.
Neither of them like you for this.
Neither of them like you.
Dude, when I was a kid, I remember this because I used to have these fire nightmares of like a firewood. We had a home fire when I was probably like 7 or 8. And then after that, I would have randomly dreams of nightmares of fires. And I kid you not, Don, every single time I would have that dream, Superman would swoop down and pull me and my family out of it. Like every single time. And so, of course, in our age of enlightenment and knowledge on levels unforeseen, where people can look at characters and assess certain things, validly so, because it's interesting and oftentimes it's very illuminating. But there, certain narratives get, you know, obsessed about characters. And I'm like, yeah, but here's the reality, man. Superman, in my mind, is still the hero that saved me and my family from fires every single time. And I, for this reason, you asked me who my character is. In it's Superman, because he saved me. And fucking, I saw Christopher Reeve. I'm sorry. I saw Superman, Clark Kent, pretending to be Christopher Reeve. And to me, I'm like, that is where that exists in my mind. And you can't tell me anything other. Some of these other ones have, I'm like, Captain America. I used to love that dude. And I'm like, I assess some of these in a different way, but
I
different combo.
Listen.
Come on.
The Avengers are cops, is all I'm saying. The Avengers are cops. And if you don't believe that, I have a book for you to read.
It's right here. Listen. Is that Steve McNiven that drew that one?
You're asking me artists. Cover? Hold on, I'm gonna tell you.
Let me see who did that cover.
I don't know. This is AVX.
I know they got her.
Oh, I know. Listen, it's an omnibus. Oh, Jesus, I'm gonna have to go look at the whole thing.
Yeah. No, don't do the whole thing. I know that. Let me see that Captain America on the front there again.
This one.
Open the cover up. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I can't tell.
It's good audio.
But yeah. Yeah, that cover. It sounded like old man near the fire. Who did that? Put it closer. Jesus. Okay. Well, you know the thing.
It's a Bendis story. I always know who the writers are.
Of course, and I always know the artist. There it is. That's the beer. Together, we'll do amazing things.
Yes.
But separate, you're going to write a lot of words and draw a lot of random ass pictures.
I do. I want to talk about fans for a second before I let you go. I want to talk about fans. So we're fans.
Okay. Before you do that, man, I'm such a fan of you, Don, man.
Oh, like, stop.
I'm seriously.
I'm just a guy.
You are a fantastic fucking reflection of the human. You are a fantastic reflection. And your stories and just the way that you traverse multiple layers of like existence in such a beautiful, kind, intelligent, creative way, you really, 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 really and truly inspire the hell out of me, man. And I'm super appreciative of you, man. So I just want to, I got to make that clear. Now, bitch, cry. Let him go. Cry,
motherfucker. I hate you so much. See, now the problem is you stuck that in the episode and it's going to be hard to edit out and I can't.
Wow.
Jennifer Hale did that to me, but she did it before I hit record and it was okay. And then she did it after I stopped hitting record. And so I didn't, it wasn't in. Oh, you jerk.
I mean every word of it, man. I really do.
So much. Really thank do. You. It's very kind. Let's talk about people that you piss
sure
off.
Thing.
So let's talk about fans. there's some interesting conversation that has come up since, and I'm kind of glad that we didn't record then so I could ask you now, fans and fan service and giving the fans what they want, but then giving the fans something they don't expect. So I've seen some stuff online where people are like, oh, you know, season two or season three or whatever of this show fell off. And, you know, I think the way that would be fixed is they need to invite fans into the writers or people that love this. Or you see people that are like, they announce a writer's room for a new show and they're like, I didn't really know much about this before I got into, or, you know, I saw the movies, but I, you know, didn't read all the extra stuff and yada, yada, and all this fan reaction online. You need to get fans in the room. That's why everything sucks these days and yada, yada, yada. Yeah. And the best criticism that I've seen to that, or the best feedback I've seen to that is, fans don't actually know what they want until you give it to them.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
That's
so
the bottom.
My question to you, and I mean, this is my revenge.
By the way, that thing you just said, the end of the quote from David Fincher was exactly that. He literally said, they don't even know what you want until you give it to them.
Yeah.
So, but carry on. I just left that part out.
So you upset me. So I'm going to upset your fans. This is going to be the part that I clip out and I put on social media.
Oh boy.
Do fans know what they want? And before you give it to them, like if you did just give fans everything they wanted, would they like something? Or, you know, how do you walk that line?
I think, yeah, fans absolutely know what they want. I think, yes, it's a both and though. Listen, I want to eat steak and mashed potatoes every day for the rest of my life, but it will fucking kill me. Ta-da. So I think, yes, fans do know what they want because they have a reference point and an experience and an appreciation and a value of it. But what fans have to acknowledge is that before they got that thing that they want, they didn't know that they wanted it. It's the both end of it. I just am like, yeah, I think fans know what they want, but my purpose is not to limit my output to what someone wants. It's a tough, so then you want something that is mutually exclusive to what this other person wants. So now I got to pick one of you guys. You know.
Especially because I was so interested to speak to you about this because you work a lot with adapted media, you know, almost yeah. exclusively yes. from your IMDb yeah. here. You almost work mm-hmm. exclusively with adapted media. So these are not mm-hmm. like Chris Copeland's stories start to finish. These are stories that are, you know, Invincible yes. was a graphic novel beforehand.
Yep.
Batman, Guardians of the Galaxy, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles versus Batman.
First, yes.
lots of questions for you about that.
Yes. Yeah. Oh,
Spider-Man, Big Hero 6. You know, these are adapted media. So you know, with adaptation, you have to figure out what was the best part. What did people love the most? What was the beating heart of the thing that you're adapting?
Yes.
And yes. How yeah. do we maybe get to that a little faster?
And yeah, 100%. And here's another thing that I will answer for you too. Here's a perspective that I have. In terms of diversity and diverse stories and diverse mm-hmm. voices. When people talk about that, what a lot of people are thinking about is optics. Mm-hmm. Put a black character, put a gay character, put an Asian character, put a left. And it's just like, yo, that's limited. That is satiating a weird want that someone has. That's not the answer. And the reason why I think it's not the answer is because here's what I believe. If I took, let's say the cry out goes, black voices are not at the forefront. We need to hear more black voices. Okay, let me take the Alien franchise, right? And I go, okay, Sigourney Weaver. I'm going to take her out of there and I'm going to put Regina King in that movie. Same script, but I'm going to put Regina King in that movie. How do I send that into a space that is authentically fresh and new? It's still the Alien franchise. And I posture and I believe that if you actually give a fuck about the people that you are putting into these things, when you actually care about those people, Regina King is a different human than Sigourney Weaver.
Very true.
Her lived experiences are different. I can take that same exact script and organically, she's going to get to a point in that script that Sigourney Weaver's character got to, and she's going to pick A instead of mm-hmm. B because mm-hmm. she is a different person.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have something to play with. Now we have a new, fresh take on a franchise that you love because this person is going to do something. So the value of humans and people is not only in what they look like and what they ascribe to. It is, no, who are you? Are you really a person? And what did you know? What did you learn? What did you see? And when you come up against this thing, what do you do in that moment? That is diversity in voices. And I believe, for me, I am not going to relegate myself to the wants and whims of an audience because I'm going, no, man. First of all, this character, this person, they have something to say. They have an existence to exist within. That if you would allow them to do that, they're probably going to expose you to something amazing. They're probably going to expose you to something that you don't give a shit about. And to that, I would say, go on to the next show and watch that. But for me, I am held to a standard of I love people. I value their stories. I value their experiences. And I want to activate as diverse a library of those stories as possible. And so I have to listen to their spirit, to their souls, to their stories, and to their preferences. And anything that deviates from that for the sake of fan service, well, the one of you that I'm saying no to is like 12 of you all that I'm exciting. And I'm going like, if you want me to pick and choose on that, we're going to have the same shit over and over and over and over and over again, which is also another reason why I don't think AI is going to go too far, is because it all just looks like a bad fucking artist who needs to learn how to draw hands, if you ask me. So
to be fair, don't we all suck at hands?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. You don't give that guy a job. That guy doesn't get a job drawing comics if he can't draw hands. What the fuck are we doing?
Every little geeky kid that got their start drawing like on the back of their book cover knows the secret to a good drawing is you put stick the pockets. Hands in their pockets.
If you look at my art on my Instagram, and you'll see I draw hands a lot. A big reason why I got into the industry is because fools can look at a portfolio. And if an artist is not even trying to draw the hands, you're like, yeah, there's a limit to this execution. I was like, fuck that. I'm there's a painter, Justin Bua. Look that dude up. Does some of the most amazing, fantastic hands you'll ever see. And he's one of my biggest inspirations. And I was like, no, I got to draw hands. But that's what I said with the AI shit. I'm like, that's the thing. You can't figure out. You're just another artist. And that's how you know.
There was also an era in the late 90s, early 2000s, where a lot of people got to cheat on the lower half of the body because they just gave everybody like flares. Do you remember that? Where like nobody had to learn how to draw an ankle at all. The feet were huge. They had these massive, massive feet, like these giant shoes and flares.
Oh, yes.
And like just you
flares
just.
Flares and boot. Yep. Yep,
yep. Just that's giant it. That's flares and hands in pockets.
Nah, man.
You can draw anything. Game up.
That's the list. I said, look, if you want your portfolio to jump out to me, let me see a bunch of hands in there and let me see some feet. Like, let me see it. And that sounds kinky, but it's not.
Right there. It's not. That's it for social God media. Let me see some hands and feet.
Hands and feet. I get the portfolio popping for me. God, cancel this fool. Jeez Louise.
Oh, man. I do one final question, then I'm gonna let you go. So if somebody wants to get where you are, somebody's starting in the industry, I'm posting on Instagram, I'm getting some notice, people are figuring I'm building my following, you know, yada yada yada. But I wanna break in. I think I'm ready to start doing some animation. I think I'm ready to start doing some cover art or something. Yeah. What's that first job somebody needs to go for? Like, what kind of jobs should somebody be looking for? How does somebody even go about, I don't know if the word's auditioning, submitting for those kinds of roles? Like, where do people start? Like, practical advice.
Yes. I will say, first of all, God bless this season of creative kids that are trying to break in, people that are trying to break in, because
there's so much talent up there.
Oh, my God, man. There's so much talent. And here's the thing. There's so much talent, and the guys that you admire that are doing the amazing things you admire, they're on Instagram and Twitter, and they doom scroll. They browse.
I know.
They like art. I got in because I was on this website called DeviantArt. This is before Twitter and all this. And DeviantArt sucks now because super AI supportive and all that trash. But back in the day, it was great because if it wasn't a comic convention, you didn't have a way to interact with the people that were making the decisions. Whereas now you can post your art, and Joaquin Dos Santos, who was one of the directors on Spider-Verse, is a fan of your art, and all of a sudden you have an audience. So one thing that I will say as a practical thing is, yeah, post your progress, post your art on there and be present on there. Study that's first. Post your art on these platforms. The other thing that I would say is do a little bit of research. And I know that sounds like, oh God, I just want to draw into the thing. But now there's interviews like this that when I got in 2009, that this type of shit did not exist. It did not exist of someone going in depth about what is a storyboard revisionist versus what's a storyboard artist. A revisionist is your entry level position. you're literally taking the storyboard that the director put the notes on and you're doing those notes. So that type of dialogue was not present out there. So jump your ass on that YouTube and stop looking at weird videos of people doing all sorts of crazy shit and actually research the industry that you want to get into, because mm-hmm. now the information is so available. And then the third thing I would say, like I said earlier, draw your ass off,
right, and then draw it back on again, and then draw it
and then draw it back and then draw back on again. What it looks like now. get that BBL. I just am like, man, you got to draw. And then it's like, okay, well, what do I draw? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of different things that I can go like, oh, well, draw this, draw that. People is always easy. Definitely got to draw people. But let's get out of that. Let me give you something super general. Research, be an audience to the things that are being made. What shows are on Netflix? What are the things that people are talking about that's cool and exciting? Study that stuff, you know, study it, look at it. That's how you go like, oh shit, I want to try to emulate that style, or I want to try to, you know, storyboard out a moment similar to that show. So looking at the content, being a wise audience is so pivotal and what we do, breaking in. And definitely when I get on a job, I remember Bruce Timm telling me, you got to fucking hit play on your storyboards, like push the play button and look at it and be an audience and go, oh, that looks like horse shit. Let me fix that and change it. So doing that even before you get in to understand what's happening in the industry and how can you bend your style and portfolio pieces to some of that stuff. That's just a smart way to go about it. That would be my advice, those three things.
It's so funny how no matter what creative I talk to in what facet of a creative field, a lot of advice comes back to, are you watching or are you reading or are you listening to what is coming out now? What's been coming out in the last two or three years in the genre that you want to make, in the space you want to play in? You know, I talk to authors or people who want to be authors all the time. And the last comp that they have for like, oh, it's going to be the next Stardust. It's going to be the next, Carrie or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, that's great. But those references are many decades old. What's come out in the last two or three years that's like, oh, well, no, nothing's like me. And I'm like, okay, listen.
Okay.
Are you reading what's in the genre right now? Are you reading what is being bought right now? Like, where do you fit in the space? What has been said and what are you saying that's different? What's your take on this? And if you can't answer that question, in addition to a few other questions I have, like, what does your character want? What, you know, what's standing in their way? How are they going to get it? You know, then maybe you're not ready. And sometimes people need to hear,
yes,
you're not ready, and that's okay. That's a kindness to hear. That's a kindness to hear.
I just think it's so beautiful what can happen when honesty and care for a person can be existent in one conversation. Like, I really care for people who want to do it, but I'm always going to be very honest and very real, and my hope is that I facilitated an atmosphere safe enough that when I'm honest with the person, that they know that I'm in no way ever trying to demean, demoralize, or, you know, erase their efforts. But going like, no, me saying you're not ready now is not me saying you won't be ready next time we interact. It's, you know, it's the journey. The journey is ever present. So
I'm so glad. I'm so glad I didn't hit 10 years ago. I'm so glad none of this happened to me 10 years ago. God. Oh, I would have put out some.
If I showed you, my brother and I laughed off of that. We were trying to break into comics before we got into animation. And when I was 16, 17, I'm like, oh, I'm clearly ready. And I look back at some of that art and I'm just like, bro, no,
the stuff I thought I was so good at. I'm so glad I didn't. I'm so glad. Some people hit it big. I know some author that they hit the list. Same. They hit the New York Times. Same. And they hit it and they got their deal at 21 and they had five books out by the time they were 25. Good for you. I'm great. So glad Kudos. It wasn't me. I'm yeah. so glad it was it not that, me because I would have fumbled that so hard. Chris Copeland.
That would have broken a lot of great experiences.
Yeah. Sure. Chris Copeland, if people want to see more of your work, what do you have coming up and where can yes. they find you online?
Oh, man. I have a lot of, God. This
you
is,
do.
This is the painful. This is the painful thing. It's like everyone's like, when can we see? And we have a feature in development here at DreamWorks, my brother and I, that we've been developing for 4 years now, and it is making progress. We have.
Do you need any voices for that? I do gay, listen, and I do
listen.
I do slightly more gay. I could do. See, I could do a gay.
You
I do this.
You think I'm.
This is this voice, is my Chris. One voice.
Can you no, Chris? I'm making it very clear. This is it. This is where you're good. Do you need this? I will hit your ass.
People,
so don't play with me.
People have been
I'm
asking me.
You.
So I got to finally I get you get it. I get to finally tell people about this thing that I've been working on for years. So I you yeah. know, I'm telling people about my new fantasy novel and people are like, oh, are you gonna do the audiobook? And I'm like, okay. I love that you want to hear me do this for 12 hours. I'm here to tell you. I am not the person to read this nonfiction. Me telling you about myself, sure. I will read. I did my last audiobook. Cool, because that's just me talking about myself. That's fine. But I know you don't want this. You don't want this for 12 hours doing accents.
Listen,
accent. Don's accent
as,
work.
Oh, God. Oh, God. But as much as I talk about being kind to yourself, I cannot tell you, Don, my brother and I, we just finished a short that we wrote and directed, actually. That's going to come out at some point.
You need any voices so I can all. Do gay? And I can
no, here's the thing. Okay, here's the thing. It's a silent film. It's a silent
Perfect.
Film, which, what, yeah, here's,
no, here's my audition.
killing it. Emmy Award.
Thank you.
Right now.
Thank you so much.
Dude, it's our composer, one of the songs she wanted my brother and I and our producer to like provide just some like backup vocal, like not singing, but just like just whatever little shit that she, and every time I hear it, I'm just like, that the voice of myself, I cannot stand it. I can't stand hearing it at all. I hate it to every inch of my soul and I don't like it. So kudos to you and any other voiceover, anyone that's done voiceover work and does not want to just fall into a river and stay there. Kudos to you guys. I hate it. I hate hearing my
voice. I don't know. I got to interview Jennifer Hale earlier this summer and I was like, I don't know how so many voices live in. I couldn't. It's a struggle. It's a struggle to edit this and put this out every other week. This is a struggle to listen to myself and the videos and stuff. I don't.
God,
So is there anything new? Listen, your IMDb, sir. What's next? What can you talk about? Anything? I know you got NDAs out the wazoo. Can you talk about anything at all? What's the next season of Invincible doing? What are we doing? Are you on Invincible?
No, I am no longer on Invincible. we've been off of that show for a few years now. Actually, my good buddy, he's like a brother. To my brother and my buddy
Sean
O'Neill.
I know there's a new Witcher. Are you involved in the Witcher? I'm just going to poke
at
things
now.
What are you on?
I am on some things a lot of things at DreamWorks, and none of the goddamn things have been announced. I am dreading. I dread that we're so close to like announcing things and whatnot. So look, go on to my Insta, Chris Copeland Art. At Chris Copeland Art and my Twitter, at Chris Copeland. It's the same, but it's no A in art. Someone had taken it. So it's just RT because I'm witty. So it's retweet. Chris Copeland retweet. But I'm going to be announcing things because I am like many people who are following me. I'm dying to just reveal to people that, yes, I am indeed creating. My brother and I are doing the best shit that we've ever done in our lives and our careers. But, you know, Studio by tells me when I can say.
By the time the movie, by the time the book, by the time of the whatever comes out, yes, and people finally get yes to listen to it or read it or watch it or whatever, it's like, I'm five projects down.
I'm
like,
just what you're, over there.
What you're reading now is what I wrote 3 years ago. And so that's how long this all takes. So it's like,
yes,
it's so hard to keep up in your brain. Okay, well then here you go. Okay, so looking at Chris Copeland Art's Instagram, what'd you think of Deadpool and Wolverine?
I still haven't seen it.
Oh, I'm so glad I didn't ask that question in a different way because I almost spoiled something.
See? No, I still haven't seen it. My 14-year-old, my wife wants to go see it too. Her birthday is coming up next Wednesday.
I'm so glad I didn't spoil this for you.
You see that? And you know how terrible
it
is?
Don't look at your own Instagram then. Don't look at your own Instagram. Yeah.
No, I can't go to my Instagram. I'll start scrolling and I'll see just like the hair from like Wolverine coming up. And if I'm like, nope, I got to roll out. So I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Chris. This is so good.
What did you? You sent me some. Okay,
no, I didn't. Mind. I did not. No, did I? Please, no. No, but no. You should not look at your Instagram because people are leaving comments under something that you did that references a spoiler in Deadpool and Wolverine. So you should not go look.
You see this? I can't.
Go watch it today. It's everywhere.
I'm leaving. Bye, guys.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Oh, my God. It's been an honor. Thank you so much, Don.
Well, that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Chris Copeland. I would tell you what he's got coming up next, but we legally cannot say. So go watch his back catalog. It's all great. It's all wonderful. Anyways, if you like the show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. The easiest and freest one, just tell a friend. Tell a friend about the show. You like this show? You like the way I do interviews? Just tell somebody. Be like, hey, Jimothy, listen to this show. You could also share it with your friends on social media. Like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help bump the show up in the algorithm and tells it to recommend it to other listeners just like you. Now, if you want to do a little bit more, you can join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, including archived episodes, early access to stuff, and little goodies along the way. I recently got to announce my debut YA fantasy novel, which is called Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire, which will be coming out in summer of 2025. And you know who the first people were to know about that book deal? It's folks on my Patreon. So if you want early access or little behind the scenes tidbits, and you know who else is going to be the first people to know about anything Verity Vox related, it's going to be them. Sign up for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/headonfirepod. It's a good time to tell you I am on all forms of social media pretty much at headonfirepod. I'm going to go. But as always, I will leave you. But I'm going to. What do I say at the end of this thing? Thank you. Goodbye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.